The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Centre Parks. Spot rare wildlife, explore the forest, and have endless adventures together.
Yeah, we'll take some music in a little while, but I want to go straight to our guest this morning. James Comey, good morning and welcome.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Not at all. We spoke briefly on Zoom to the TV show I was doing in the middle of COVID, and we spoke about your Irish connections and everything. I thought you might get a chance to get over here, but they wouldn't let you cross the Irish Sea, no?
No, that's exactly right. I was hoping I would as well. But I'm sorry, this is a poor substitute for visiting the beautiful place.
Let's talk about what you've been up to, because you've written a book called Central Park West, and it's a novel. You've of course written a couple of books that are non-fiction, but this is a completely different world. Why don't you? We've got lots of places to go this morning, James. But let's begin with the synopsis of the book and give us a flavour of it, and then we'll get stuck in.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. It's based in Manhattan, and it tells the story of a federal prosecutor for the U.S. Department of Justice named Nora Carlton, my protagonist, who is handling a mob case and not paying attention to a case involving the murder of a former governor that's being prosecuted in state court just down the block. But those two cases slam together in ways she never expected. And so it's about the journey that takes her on, along with her sidekick, who's her investigator named Benny Dugan. And it's the story of those people and takes the readers inside what those cases are really like, because I did those kind of cases.
That's right. So you were the state attorney in New York, and you know these courtrooms. In fact, and your daughter continues to know these courtrooms. Tell us a little bit about, you know, even courtroom 318, a significant place in your life.
Yeah, 318 is a courtroom, a grand courtroom in the old federal courthouse in Lower Manhattan. And it was the place in which my great friend Patrick Fitzgerald and I prosecuted John and Joe Gambino, two major mobsters, for 6 months when my oldest daughter, Maureen, was a little girl. She was 4 years old. And when I was working on this book, she was in the same courtroom, now a grown woman and the chief of the Violent and Organized Crime Unit, in the same office in which I had worked. And she was on her feet in that same courtroom in a weird crossover of life, prosecuting Ghislaine Maxwell, Jeffrey Epstein's partner in abusing a lot of young girls. And so the protagonist had to be a woman, and I named her Nora so as not to embarrass my daughter too much, but she's inspired by my daughter Maureen and my other daughters, and I use her as the vehicle to tell the story.
I think it's really important to make that point, that because you're the proud father of four daughters. So if you didn't put in smart female protagonists in your novel, you probably would be disinvited for Thanksgiving next year.
I think that's right. And the advantage of it being a compilation of all four daughters is if any one of them doesn't like some part of the character, I can say it's based on your sister.
Good one, good one. And I wonder, are your daughters kind of thumbing through it going, that's me, that's her, that's me, that's the other one? I mean, is that the kind of filial feedback you've been getting?
Yes, they went through it very carefully in draft. And among other things, my oldest, Maureen, pointed out that I had put her office on the wrong floor, so I adjusted that. But I think overall they're happy with the portrayal. Their father did not embarrass them.
Well, speaking of, can you remind us what height you are, James?
I am 6'8" tall.
And when you, as a proud dad, want to stand discreetly in the back of the courtroom to see how Maureen is getting on in prosecuting the bad guys, how do you achieve that, or is it possible?
It's funny you should say that, because she forbid me to come to the Maxwell trial in courtroom 318, telling me, if you come, Dad, quote, it'll be a thing, which I think she means a bad thing. And so I couldn't go. My much more normal height wife went and gave me the reports from there. I've gotten a chance to watch Maureen in action, and I kind of slip in the back and try and sit in one of the rear benches.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you have some class of disguise, and COVID might have helped, in fact, with the mask in some way, going some way to mitigate for everything. Let's talk about your wife, if I may, briefly, Patrice. She is critical to the genesis of your book. I don't know if there's probably a series, I've no doubt, but tell us about her role in terms of conception, ideas-wise, and then execution of the plan.
Well, she's the idea person, so it's her responsibility to come up with ideas for a story and to pitch a story line. And she has great story vision, and she's read a tremendous amount of fiction and crime fiction. So I couldn't do it without her. And then my job is to agree upon that vision and then go off and write it, and then every day get feedback on a Google Doc from her, which is easier to get when it's remotely. It's not as painful to me. But then I make adjustments based on that feedback, and then the next day do it again and again and again until it's ready to be read by all of my children.
And if you were to be handed those notes and be in the same room as your wife, would that have caused some friction in your marriage, do you think?
No, I think it'd just be more painful for me. Everyone has a different relationship, but I go through a process where when I'm corrected on something, I initially deny that she's right, and then my next step is to think she may be right, and then the final step is, of course she's right, and it's better if I can go through that process privately. It's less painful.
And can I ask you what your wife does for a living?
She works with foster children. She's trained as a marriage and family therapist.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of work to help kids in distress.
Okay. And as a family therapist, I suppose she can on occasion bring her work home with her to deal with all of you.
Yeah, she's. I always tell people she didn't become a therapist because of me, but it's been very beneficial.
Did you, when you were involved with as a state attorney and then later in the FBI, did you find yourself not wanting to read books and related matter to what your job, or were you tempted to dip into crime thrillers and what have you, or did you let that just leave Patrice to all of that?
Not intentionally, but because I found it so hard to think about that in my spare time, my days were filled with crime and terrorism and espionage. It was very hard to watch television programs or read about it, not because authors got it wrong, but because I just wanted to get away from it. And so I just before I became a prosecutor in 1987, I read the crime thriller by Scott Turow, Presumed Innocent. Mm-hmm. And I really wasn't able to get back to that work for 30 years, probably. And so it was after getting fired in 2017 that the farther I got from the work, the easier it became to think about it and then to write about it. And the distance is what made the difference.
And who did you kind of gravitate towards when you were maybe doing a little research or trying to find your groove for writing Central Park West?
I started by reading John le Carré's work. Mm-hmm. I think I read all Le Carré's books, both because he's a legend in the field and also because I gather he had struggled with how to make the fiction accurate but also exciting. And could he actually hold readers' attention if he depicted it, the spy business, the way he really found it? Because I wanted to tell the actual story about how it works, not make things up except making up characters, but having the procedures be the way they really are. And I've tried to do that, and I think it holds the excitement. I haven't had people, I haven't been fantastical in the way I've depicted these cases because you don't need to be exciting.
Your grandfather was a cop, was he?
Yeah, he was. A child of Irish immigrants. He dropped out of school in the sixth grade to support his family when his dad was killed in an industrial accident in New York, and then he became a police officer and became the leader of the Yonkers, New York Police Department.
Right. Classic Irish trajectory, I mean to join the police force like that. And then when you were a young boy, you and your brother James were at home when a burglar broke into your house. Can you give us a bit of detail of what happened that evening?
Yeah. And when I was a senior in high school,
yeah,
there was a robber and rapist who the press had dubbed the Ramsey rapist, a serial attacker, kicked in the front door of my parents' one-story home in New Jersey. And the police said, apparently looking for my sister, who thank God wasn't there, and found me and my brother and held us captive that night and threatened to kill us, and we escaped. And then he said he was going to kill us again, and we escaped again. It was a wild and terrifying night. And had left a lasting impression on me, as you might imagine.
You were what age were you at that point, James? And for how long?
I was 17, so I was a senior in high school.
Okay.
Last year before university.
What did that do to you in the short term?
You know, I'm an unreliable narrator about myself, I think, but at least consciously, it didn't steer me into law enforcement, although it seems obvious now, given my family and that experience. But it made me grow up in a lot of ways very, very quickly. And when I became an investigator and a prosecutor, it made me much, much better at understanding the pain of victims, because I had only gone through a very small piece of what women who were sexually assaulted by this guy experienced, but I could feel enough of that pain that it made me better at my job.
You also have strong thoughts, as most right-minded people do, about bullies. Were you bullied as a youngster? I mean, we've talked about your height. Maybe that was a factor, but what was happening in that regard?
I was. Especially because we moved from Yonkers, New York, to just across the Hudson River when I was a kid, and I thought I was moving to another country, and I stuck out. I had a bit of a New York accent that the New Jersey kids didn't, and I had very big feet and a very big mouth, but not a big body at that point in my life. And so I would always have some clever quip that the bullies were confused by and probably infuriated by. And so I dealt with a lot of it during my grade school years. And that's something that stayed with me. I've always thought of like the mafia as among the biggest bullies there are. And I took a lot of satisfaction in putting those bullies away.
The mafia families that you were dealing with were, how would you describe them? Because I know you've talked in the past about the Godfather film and the effect that might have even had, and the book obviously, might have had on a certain generation of mafioso families, and how once upon a time they might have been discreet in their violence and then they became more effete, if you like, more peacockery with it all. Talk to me a little bit about that and what drove you to, you've alluded to a little bit, but what drove you to really go for it and take them down?
So the New York Italian organized crime, La Cosa Nostra, the five families, were really shaped by art in an odd way, because the U.S. Mafia stopped inducting new members in 1957 because the bosses of the major families thought they were losing control of who was getting in. And they didn't take any new members again until 1975, when at that point each of the five families could make 10 members. And so what that meant was from 1957 to 1975, there was an entire generation of really bad people who could not get on the inside. Well, the Godfather landed in 1972 in the States and shaped those people, because the Godfather wasn't, in many ways it was accurate, but in many ways it depicted La Cosa Nostra in a way different from reality. But the mobsters who couldn't get it on the inside saw the movie and thought, in fact, one of them explained to me, he remembered the day he walked out of the theater and he said, the light hit my face on 18th Avenue in Brooklyn, and I thought, that's the life. Mm. And so they started talking that way and imitating the dress and the cadence of those characters. And then when they were finally able to get into the mafia, those Hollywood-shaped hoodlums reshaped Cosa Nostra and its culture a bit and made it much more prominent. You know, John Gotti used to wear $5,000 suits and march up and down the street and get his hair cut every day. And that they were shaped by Hollywood. And of course, what successive mobsters have realized is that's really dumb, because you stand up and down in a $5,000 suit and get your hair cut every day, the FBI is going to put your picture at the top of a bulletin board and your future is going to be limited. And so over the last 10, 20 years, they've gotten much more clever and realized that fame is a recipe for a long jail sentence.
It's like you're describing, to keep the movie analogy going, the transition from the Godfather to Goodfellas, which of course was, you know,
yes,
they became, as you say, ostentatious with it. And what was it like for you to confront these guys in the courtroom? And were you confident you could take them down? And the feeling of ultimately listening to verdicts being read out?
It was surreal to deal with these characters in a courtroom, because they really do tell themselves that they're a uomo d'onore, a man of honor, and that they live by a code. And of course, it's all nonsense. I mean, the code is broken as often as it's followed, but they they try to convince themselves and you as the prosecutor that we are both noble warriors just on different sides. And so there's a certain honor to the conflict. And look, I didn't mind that because that meant they weren't going to try to kill me. They saw me as a honorable opponent. So there was that weird dance, but seemed almost oddly civilized in the courtroom. Mm. I had a mafia hitman once pass me a note congratulating me on receiving an honor from the New York City Bar Association and saying that he read of it and it's well-deserved and signing his name. And that's insane because I was trying to put him in jail for the rest of his life. The presenting the case is very difficult especially against the high-level mobsters, because it turns on getting other really bad people to become witnesses to testify against, up the chain, against senior people. And that's a dangerous dance because obviously using criminals to get criminals risks the integrity of the prosecution, because these senior mobsters are only alive because they're wily and have become really good liars, frankly. And so using them in the pursuit of justice is a fraught enterprise. But look, it's very, very satisfying because these people, although glorified in a lot of our media, even in a Goodfellas, which shows the darker side better than The Godfather, these people are people who just terrorized innocent people. They're the bullies that made you walk a different way in the schoolyard on the scale of a city. And so honest business people trying to run a butcher shop or trying to run a carpentry business are terrified by these people. And to relieve that burden from those people is what made it fulfilling to be a prosecutor.
When you got to the top of the FBI, James Comey, how did that make you feel? I'm thinking of the young lad who was mocked at school, or the young fella who was, you know, held at gunpoint by the Ramsey rapist. Now you hit the top. Tell me about that achievement for you as a son, as a father, as a brother.
It was both a thrill and a source of the imposter complex, feeling like, what am I doing here? A kid who used to wear white socks with black shoes and get mocked for it. And so I think that's a healthy balance, that I was both excited to be there and wondered why on earth President Obama would want me to do it. But I loved the work, and the best part of the work was the people of that organization, who are just fundamentally good people trying to do something to serve their country and to help protect innocent people. I loved being with them, but I never quite lost that sense. When I would walk into a room and they would stand up when I came in, I'd think, why are they standing up? It's just me. But they were standing up for the role. And once I realized that, some of the discomfort went away. It wasn't about me. It was about their respect for the hierarchy reflected in the director's office.
And when Barack Obama called you in and said, I just want to have a quick conversation with you before you got the nod, did he call you in for that first time to say congratulations, or do you think he wanted to look in the whites of your eyes?
I think probably a little bit looking me in the whites of my eyes to get to know me better. And also I think he did, enjoyed our first conversation, and he knew that once he nominated me to be the FBI director, he would never speak to me again personally.
Okay.
Because it's been a tradition in America for the last 50 years, as a result of some of the excesses of the first 50 years of the FBI when J. Edgar Hoover led the organization. It's been along the tradition that presidents keep a certain distance from FBI directors so that the FBI doesn't become political. It's apart from the political power in the presidency. And so President Obama was explicit about that and said, once I name you, you and I will never speak like this again. And I just wanted to talk to you. And so we just talked like two people in a pub might talk about all kinds of things. And then at the end, he said, well, okay, good luck. And then we never had a personal conversation like that again.
Amazing. And even your description of the job as being depoliticized, and you know where I'm going to go next, obviously, because you became a complete target of hate, and I presume much worse, by both the left and the right. The left said, because of the investigation into the Clinton emails, that directly led to the election of Donald Trump, and the right said, well, you were chasing the Trump presidency or Trump campaign about Russian involvement and so on. Take us to the eye of that storm. Where did you find solace, and how challenging was it for you intellectually and emotionally?
Yeah, it certainly was a storm, but oddly at the center of it, the fact that both the right and the left thought you were on the other side's team, which is crazy because we weren't on anybody's team, but the fact that you were getting both wings of the passionate American political spectrum angry at you was freeing in a way, that you knew that no matter what you did, you were going to be criticized. And it may sound odd to your listeners to hear that, but there's something freeing in that. It's like being the referee. You know that the crowd's going to yell at you no matter what you do, so just do your job. Also, being surrounded by people at the Bureau who were the kind of people I described was also helped make the center calm, both in a larger sense and literally. One of the pieces of the FBI that people don't realize is that there's this culture where the tenser things get, the quieter and calmer everyone speaks. Mm. And so someone can come in and give you horrible news, and the FBI culture would say, you respond not by saying, oh my God, you say more.
Okay.
Very quietly like that. And so there's this sense that we are culturally calm, we are apart from politics, we are alone, and there's a certain security in that. And look, the way I dealt with it was just make sure don't we read Twitter comments, try not to have the window of hate open too wide, and also just spending time with my family, making sure I get exercise and sleep, and hugging my children and my wife just is a way to step away from the craziness. But look, it was not easy, but sometimes it's not as hard as, for the reasons I said, as people may think from the outside.
And where were you on election night?
I was home and went to sleep. Again, because the nature of the FBI, the job, has lots of other aspects that aren't obvious to the public, and it requires regular sleep. And so I thought, well, okay, I'm going to bed. And so I'm a pretty disciplined person, so I was able to sleep through the night.
And the next morning?
The next morning, I'm forgetting when they called the election. I think I woke up and my wife told me that they called the election for Donald Trump, and my reaction was, okay, I hope to God we had no role in that outcome, in affecting that outcome. It doesn't change how I think about the decisions we had to make, but I pray that we weren't an impact on the election, and we'll just go forward and do the best we can.
And are you reading from the book of Edith Piaf? Is it Je ne regrette rien? Is that where you're coming from on all of it?
Your French is better than mine, but
no,
yeah,
no regrets. You know,
I have deep regrets about being involved. I really don't think about the key decisions differently, even after reflecting on it 1,000 times and talking about it 1,000 times. Mm. I think we faced an impossible decision tree. There were two doors; they both led to hell, and we chose the least bad option of what faced us. And I still think that, even after all this time.
In terms of the next election, it looks like we're in the twilight zone, and it's going to be Trump Biden. Any thoughts?
Yeah, and not just Trump Biden, but a twice indicted, maybe more than that before the next election, and we could really have it sounds crazy to say, if you put this in a script or a book proposal, it would get rejected as fantastical and ridiculous. But we could have a president subject to a term of incarceration, a presidential candidate at the time he's running for office. It looks like on the current course and speed, the Republicans will remain crazy enough to nominate Donald Trump, and he's in a world of trouble criminally. I've read the indictment in the classified documents case, but it looks like we're going to rerun the election, but rerun it with all kinds of more complications around Donald Trump.
It's flummoxing, to say the least, but that's what's coming down the tracks. James, we have to leave it there. I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. I hope we do it again sometime. Congratulations on your entry into the fiction market with Central Park West. Appreciate your time this morning and wish you well.
Great to be with you. Hope to do it again.
Yep, here, here. Okay, James Comey, former head of the FBI and now novelist, joining us live this morning from London, England. His book is called Central Park West, and I think fans of crime and, I suppose, police procedure, really, in court drama, will enjoy that no end. Okay, James Comey, live this morning at 10 to 10.